SI rating picks up on a subtle increase in heart rate or a slight sensation of dizziness or a vague, unidentifiable fluttering in the chest. This perception, in turn, produces a frisson of conscious anxiety. Am I having a heart attack? Which causes those physical sensations to intensify. The individual immediately perceives this intensification of sensation, which in turn generates more anxiety, which produces still more intensified sensations, and before long, the individual is in the throes of panic. A number of recent studies published in periodicals like the Journal of Psychosomatic Research have found a powerful interrelationship among anxiety sensitivity, irritable bowel syndrome, worry, and a personality trait known as neuroticism, which psychologists define, as you would expect, a tendency to dwell on the negative, a high susceptibility to excessive feelings of anxiety, guilt, and depression, and a predisposition to overreact to minor stress. Unsurprisingly, people who score high on cognitive measures of neuroticism are disproportionately prone to developing phobias, panic disorder, and depression. People who score low on the neuroticism scale are disproportionately resistant to those disorders. Evidence suggests that people with irritable bowels have bodies that are more physically reactive to stress. I recently came across an article in the medical journal Gut that explained the circular relationship between cognition, your conscious thought, and physiological correlates, what your body does in response to that thought. People who are less anxious tend to have minds that don't overreact to stress and bodies that don't overreact to stress when their minds experience it, while clinically anxious people tend to have sensitive minds in sensitive bodies. Small amounts of stress set them to worrying, and small amounts of worrying set their bodies to malfunctioning. People with nervous stomachs are also more likely than people with settled stomachs to complain of headaches, palpitations, shortness of breath, and general fatigue. Some evidence suggests that people with irritable bowel syndrome have greater sensitivity to pain, are more likely to complain about minor ailments like colds, and are more likely to consider themselves sick than other people. Most cases of stomach upset, the physiologist Walter Cannon wrote back in 1909, are nervous in origin. In his article, The Influence of Emotional States on the Functions of the Alimentary Canal, Cannon concluded that anxious thoughts had direct effects, through the nerves of the sympathetic nervous system, on both the physical movements of the stomach, that is, on peristalsis, the process by which the digestive system moves food through the alimentary canal, and gastric secretions. Cannon's theory has been borne out by modern surveys conducted at primary care centers, which find that most routine stomach trouble emanates from mental distress. Between 42% and 61% of all patients with functional bowel disorders have also been given an official psychiatric diagnosis, most often anxiety or depression. One study has found a 40% overlap between patients with panic disorder and functional GI disease. As further evidence that a great deal of stomach trouble starts in the brain, not in the gut, no stomach medication has yet been proved consistently effective against the symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome, but substantial evidence suggests that certain antidepressant medications can be effective. Before the 1960s, one of the most frequent prescriptions for IBS was a cocktail of morphine and barbiturates. In a recent study, IBS patients injected with the SSRI antidepressant Celexa reported reduced visceral hypersensitivity. Michael Gershon, a professor of pathology and cell biology at Columbia University, says that the reason antidepressants reduce IBS symptoms is not that they affect neurotransmitters in the brain, but that they affect neurotransmitters in the stomach. Some 95% of the serotonin in our bodies can be found in our stomachs. When serotonin was discovered in the 1930s, it was originally called enteramine because of its high concentration in the gut. Gershon calls the stomach the second brain and observes that stomach trouble is as likely to beget anxiety as the other way around. The brain and the bowel has got to work right, or no one will have the luxury to think at all, he says. No one thinks straight when his mind is focused on the toilet. Fear brings about diarrhea, Aristotle wrote, because the emotion causes an augmenting of heat in the belly. Hippocrates attributed both bowel trouble and anxiety, not to mention hemorrhoids and acne, to a surplus of black bile. Galen, the ancient Roman physician, blamed yellow bile. People attacked by fear experience no slight inflow of yellow bile into the stomach, he observed, which makes them feel a gnawing sensation, and they do not cease feeling both distress of mind and the gnawing until they have vomited up the bile. But it was only in 1833, with the publication of a monograph called Experiments and Observations on the Gastric Juice and the Physiology of Digestion, that the link between emotional states and indigestion began to be understood with any kind of scientific precision. On June 6, 1822, Alexis St. Martin, a hunter employed by the American Fur Company, was accidentally shot in the stomach at close range by a musket loaded with buckshot. He was expected to die, but under the care of William Beaumont, a physician in upstate New York, he survived, albeit with an unusual condition, an unhealed open hole or fistula in his stomach. Beaumont realized that the hunter's fistula provided a remarkable opportunity for scientific observation. He could literally see into St. Martin's stomach. Over the next decade, Beaumont conducted many experiments using the hunter's fistula as a window into his digestive workings. Beaumont noticed that St. Martin's emotional states had a powerful effect on his stomach, one readily observable to the naked eye. The mucosal lining of the hunter's stomach would change color dramatically, like a mood ring, in tandem with his emotional states. Sometimes the stomach lining was bright red. At other times, such as when St. Martin was anxious, it turned pale. I have availed myself of the opportunity afforded by an occurrence of circumstances which can probably never occur again, Beaumont wrote. But he was wrong. Medical literature records at least two subsequent instances of digestion research conducted on patients with holes in their stomachs over the course of the next century. And then, in 1941, Stuart Wolf and Harold Wolf, physicians at New York Hospital in Manhattan, discovered Tom. One day in 1904, when Tom was 9 years old, he took a swig of what he thought was beer. It was in his father's beer pail, but turned out to be boiling hot clam chowder. The chowder seared his upper digestive tract and knocked him unconscious. By the time his mother delivered him to the hospital, his esophagus had fused shut. For the rest of his life, the only way for him to receive nourishment was through a surgically opened hole in the stomach wall. The hole was ringed on the outside by a segment of his stomach lining. He fed himself by chewing his food and then inserting it directly into his stomach through a funnel placed in the hole in his abdomen. Tom came to the attention of Doctors Wolf and Wolf in 1941 when, while working as a sewer laborer, he was compelled to seek medical assistance after his wound became irritated. Recognizing the unusual research opportunity represented by Tom's condition, the doctors hired him as a lab assistant and conducted multiple experiments on him over the course of 7 months. The results were published in their 1943 book, Human Gastric Function, a landmark of psychosomatic research. Building on Beaumont's findings, the doctors observed that the lining of Tom's stomach varied significantly in color based on its level of activity, from faint yellowish red to a deep cardinal shade. Greater levels of digestive activity tended to correlate with deeper shades of red, suggesting increased blood flow to the stomach, while lesser levels, including those induced by anxiety, correlated with paler colors, suggesting the flow of blood away from the stomach. The doctors were able to chart correlations that had long been assumed but were never scientifically proved. One afternoon, another doctor barged into the lab, swearing to himself and rapidly opening and closing drawers looking for documents that had been mislaid. Tom, whose job it was to keep the lab tidy, became alarmed. He feared he would lose his job. The lining of his stomach went instantly pale, dropping from 90% redness on the color scale to 20%. Acid secretion nearly stopped. When the doctor found the missing papers a few minutes later, acid secretion resumed, and the color gradually returned to Tom's stomach. At some level, all this is unsurprising. Everyone knows that anxiety can cause gastrointestinal distress. My friend Anne says that the most effective weight loss program she ever tried was the stressful divorce diet. But human gastric function represented the first time that the connections had been charted in such precise and systematic detail. The relationship between Tom's mental state and his digestion was not vague and diffuse. His stomach was a concrete and direct register of his psychology. Summing up their observations, Wolf and Wolf concluded that there was a strong inverse correlation between what they called emotional security and stomach discomfort. That's certainly true in my case. Being anxious makes my stomach hurt and my bowels loosen. My stomach hurting and my bowels loosening makes me more anxious, which makes my stomach hurt more and my bowels even looser, and so nearly every trip of any significant distance from home ends up the same way, with me scurrying frantically from restroom to restroom on a kind of grand tour of the local latrines. For instance, I don't have terribly vivid recollections of the Vatican or the Colosseum or the Italian rail system. I do, however, have searing memories of the public restrooms in the Vatican and at the Colosseum and in various Italian train stations. One day, I visited the Trevi Fountain, or rather, my wife and her family visited the Trevi Fountain. I visited the restroom of a nearby gelateria, where a series of impatient Italians banged on the door while I bivouacked there. The next day, when the family drove to Pompeii, I gave up and stayed in bed, a reassuringly short distance from the bathroom. Some years earlier, following the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact, I traveled to Eastern Europe to visit a girlfriend, Anne, who was studying in Poland. She had been there for 6 months by the time I visited. I had planned and aborted, because of anxiety, several previous trips, and only the fear that Anne would finally break up with me if I didn't visit her impelled me to fight through my tremendous dread of a transatlantic flight to meet her in Warsaw. Drugged to near unconsciousness, I flew from Boston to London and then to Warsaw. Befogged by sedatives, anti-emetic medications, and jet lag, I stumbled through our first day and a half together. My bowels percolated to life about the time the rest of me did, when the Dramamine and Xanax wore off. We ended up traipsing around Eastern Europe from restroom to restroom. This was frustrating for her and harrowing for me, because, among other reasons, many Eastern European public commodes were at that time rather primitive. You often had to pay an attendant in advance on a per-sheet basis for scratchy, ill-constructed toilet paper. By the end of the trip, I'd given up. Anne went sightseeing while I retreated to our hotel room, where at least I didn't have to gauge my toilet tissue use in advance. Anne, understandably, grew peevish about this. After visiting the home of Franz Kafka, who, I note, suffered from chronic bowel trouble, we walked across Wenceslas Square in Prague while I griped about my aching belly. Anne could no longer contain her exasperation. "Maybe you should write a dissertation about your stomach," she said, mocking my preoccupation. A preoccupation, you may have noticed, that I have yet to overcome. But when your stomach governs your existence, it's hard not to be preoccupied with it. A few searing experiences, soiling yourself on an airplane, say, or on a date, will focus you passionately on your gastrointestinal tract. You need to devote effort to planning around it, because it will not always plan around you. Case in point. 15 years ago, while researching my first book, I spend part of the summer living with the extended Kennedy family on Cape Cod. One weekend, then-President Bill Clinton, who was vacationing on Martha's Vineyard, came across Nantucket Sound to go sailing with Ted Kennedy. Hyannisport, where the Kennedys have their vacation homes, was crawling with presidential aides and Secret Service agents. With some time to kill before dinner, I decided to walk around town to take in the scene. Bad idea. As is so often the case with irritable bowel syndrome, it was at precisely the moment I passed beyond easily accessible bathroom range that my clogged plumbing came unglued. Sprinting back to the house where I was staying, I was several times convinced I would not make it and, teeth gritted, sweating voluminously, was reduced to evaluating various bushes and storage sheds along the way for their potential as ersatz outhouses. Imagining what might ensue if a Secret Service agent were to happen upon me, crouched in the shrubbery, lent a kind of panicked, otherworldly strength to my efforts at self-possession. As I approached the entrance, I was simultaneously reviewing the floor plan in my head. Which of the many bathrooms in the mansion is closest to the front door? Can I make it all the way upstairs to my room? And praying that I wouldn't be fatally waylaid by a stray Kennedy or celebrity. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Liza Minnelli, and the Secretary of the Navy, among others, were visiting that weekend. Fortunately, I made it into the house unaccosted. Then a quick calculation. Can I make it all the way upstairs and down the hall to my suite in time? Or should I duck into the bathroom in the front hall? Hearing footsteps above and fearing a protracted encounter, I opted for the latter and slipped into the bathroom, which was separated from the front hall by an anteroom and two separate doors. I scampered through the anteroom and flung myself onto the toilet. My relief was extravagant and almost metaphysical. But then I flushed, and something happened. My feet were getting wet. I looked down and saw, to my horror, that water was flowing out from the base of the toilet. Something seemed to have exploded. The floor, along with my shoes and pants and underwear, was covered in sewage. The water level was rising. Instinctively, I stood up and turned around. Could the flooding be stopped? I removed the porcelain top of the toilet tank, scattering the flowers and potpourri that sat atop it, and frantically began fiddling with its innards. I tried things blindly, raising this and lowering that, jiggling this and wiggling that, fishing around in the water for something that might stem the swelling tide. Somehow, whether of its own accord or as a result of my haphazard fiddling, the flooding slowed and then stopped. I surveyed the scene. My clothes were drenched and soiled. So was the bathroom rug. Without thinking, I slipped out of my pants and boxer shorts, wrapped them in the waterlogged rug, and jammed the whole mess into the wastebasket, which I stashed in the cupboard under the sink. Have to deal with this later, I thought to myself. It was at this unpropitious moment that the dinner bell rang, signaling that it was time to muster for cocktails in the living room, which was right across the hall from the bathroom, where I was standing ankle deep in sewage. I pulled all the hand towels off the wall and dropped them on the ground to start sopping up some of the toilet water. I got down on my hands and knees and, unraveling the whole roll of toilet paper, began dabbing frenziedly at the water around me. It was like trying to dry a lake with a kitchen sponge. What I was feeling at that point was not, strictly speaking, anxiety. Rather, it was a resigned sense that the jig was up, that my humiliation would be complete and total. I'd soiled myself, destroyed the estate's septic system, and might soon be standing half-naked before God knows how many members of the political and Hollywood elite. In the distance, voices were moving closer. It occurred to me that I had two choices. I could hunker down in the bathroom, hiding and waiting out the cocktail party and dinner, at the risk of having to fend off anyone who might start banging on the door, and used the time to try to clean up the wreckage before slipping up to my bedroom after everyone had gone to bed. Or I could try to make a break for it. I took all of the soiled towels and toilet paper and shoved them into the cupboard, then set about preparing my escape. I retrieved the least soiled towel, which was nonetheless dirty and sodden, and wrapped it gingerly around my waist. I crept to the door and listened for voices and footsteps, trying to gauge distance and speed of approach. Knowing I had scarcely any time before everyone converged on the center of the house, I slipped out the bathroom door and through the anteroom, sprint-walked across the hallway and darted up the stairs. I hit the first landing, made a hairpin turn, and headed up the next flight to the second floor, where I nearly ran headlong into John F. Kennedy Jr. and another man. "Hi, Scott," Kennedy said. I just met him for the first time the day before. "I'm John Kennedy," he had said when he extended his hand in introduction. "I know," I had thought as I extended mine, thinking it funny that he had to pretend courteously that people might not know his name, when in fact only a hermit or a Martian wouldn't have known who he was, so ubiquitous was his face on the cover of checkout counter magazines. Hi, I said, racking my brain for a plausible explanation for why I might be running through the house at cocktail hour with no pants on, drenched in sweat, swaddled in a soiled and reeking towel. But he and his friend appeared utterly unfazed, as though half-naked house guests covered in their own excrement were frequent occurrences here, and walked past me down the stairs. I scrambled down the hallway to my room, where I showered vigorously, changed, and generally tried to compose myself as best I could, which was not easy because I was continuing to sweat terribly right through my blazer, the result of anxiety, exertion, and summer humidity. If someone had snapped a photo of the scene at cocktails that evening, here's what it would show. Various celebrities and politicians and priests all glowing with grace and easy bonhomie as they mingle effortlessly on the veranda overlooking the Atlantic, while, just off to the side, a sweaty young writer stands awkwardly gulping gin and tonics and thinking about how far he is from fitting in with this illustrious crowd, and about how not only is he not rich or famous or accomplished or particularly good-looking, but he cannot even control his own bowels, and therefore is better suited for the company of animals or infants than of adults, let alone adults as luminous and significant as these. The sweaty young writer is also worrying about what will happen when someone tries to use the hallway bathroom. Late that night, after everyone had gone off to bed, I sneaked back down to the bathroom with a garbage bag and paper towels and cleaning detergent I'd purloined from the pantry. I couldn't tell whether anyone had been there since I left, but I tried not to worry about that, and concentrated on stuffing the soiled rug and towels and clothes and toilet paper I'd stashed under the sink into the trash bag. Then I used the paper towels to scrub the floors, and I put those into the trash bag as well. Outside the kitchen, between the main house and an outbuilding, was a dumpster. My plan was to dispose of everything there. Naturally, I was terrified of getting caught. What exactly would a houseguest be doing disposing of a large trash bag outside in the middle of the night? I worried that there might still be Secret Service afoot, who might shoot me before allowing me to plant what looked like a bomb or a body in the dumpster. But what choice did I have? I slunk through the house and out to the dumpster, where I deposited the trash bag. Then I went back upstairs to bed. No one ever said anything to me about the hallway bathroom or about the missing rug and towels, but for the rest of the weekend and on my subsequent visits there, I was convinced that the household staff were glaring at me and whispering, "That's him." I imagine they were saying in disgust, "The one who broke the toilet and ruined our towels. The one who can't control his own bodily functions." As bad as my own agoraphobic belly sometimes seems to me, others have it worse. One of the more alarming case studies I've come across was of a 45-year-old man who showed up at a mental health clinic in Kalamazoo, Michigan in 2007. He had been suffering from acute travel anxiety for 20 years, ever since the time a panic attack caused him to vomit and lose control of his bowels. Since then, the man had not been able to travel more than 10 miles from home without experiencing uncontrollable vomiting and diarrhea. Clinicians later mapped his comfort zone by his symptoms. The farther from home he went, the more dramatic his eruptions. So violent were his gastrointestinal reactions that on several occasions he had to be rushed to emergency rooms because he was vomiting blood. After physicians ruled out ulcers and stomach cancer, he was finally referred to the psychology clinic, and he was, his therapist told me when I met him at a conference in 2008, successfully treated with a combination of exposure therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. Most persons with a sore colon are of a tense, sensitive, nervous temperament. They may be calm externally, but they usually seethe internally. Walter C. Alvarez, Nervousness, Indigestion, and Pain, 1943. Of course, I know that such shame should not attach to what is officially a medical condition. Irritable bowel syndrome is a common gastrointestinal complaint frequently associated with mood and anxiety disorders, as has been observed since ancient times. In 1943, the eminent gastroenterologist Walter Alvarez noted in his delightfully titled Nervousness, Indigestion, and Pain that there is no more reason a person should feel ashamed about a nervous stomach than someone should feel ashamed at blushing at a compliment or weeping at a sad play. The nervousness and hypersensitivity that such physical reactions produce, Alvarez wrote, are associated with personality traits that, if properly used and controlled, can do much to help a man succeed. Alvarez observed that the most common source of his patient's chronic stomach discomfort was the challenges of modern living. The stomach specialist has to be a psychiatrist of sorts, he wrote. He must spend hours each week trying to teach neurotic persons to live more sensibly. One young woman was referred to Alvarez after vomiting day and night for a week. When he learned that she had recently received an ominous letter from the Internal Revenue Service, he treated her by paying her back taxes. It turned out she owed only $3.85, and she was instantly cured. Another patient, whom Alvarez described as a tense, high-pressure type of sales manager, came to him because he loved poker but couldn't play it. If he got a good hand, he would become nauseated and chilly, and his face would turn red. Bluffing was impossible, because any time he was dealt a full house or better, he would immediately have to get up and vomit. But the cruelest prank of nature Alvarez ever saw was the way nervous stomachs could destroy the love lives of the anxious. He treated one woman who would get stomach cramps and have to move her bowels whenever she was touched by a man. Another who belched uncontrollably whenever a date became intimate, and numerous others who would break wind or vomit in romantic moments. In his memoirs, the legendary lover Casanova reported on his escapades with a woman who, whenever she became sexually excited, would pass large quantities of gas. Alvarez also treated several men who were divorced by outraged wives because of their having to stop and run to the toilet whenever they became sexually excited. But a nervous stomach is bad enough. What's most disabling to me is that my nervous stomach itself makes me nervous. That's the infernal thing about being an anxious emetophobe. The very fact of one's stomach hurting is itself often the most acute source of fear. Anytime your stomach hurts, you worry you might vomit. Thus, being anxious makes your stomach hurt, and your stomach hurting makes you anxious, which in turn makes your stomach hurt more, which makes you more anxious, and so on and so forth in a vicious cycle that hurtles rapidly toward panic. The lives of emetophobes are largely built around their phobia. Some have not worked or left their houses for years because of their fears and cannot bear even to say or write vomit or related words. Online emetophobia communities usually have rules requiring that such words be rendered as, for instance, quote, V asterisk asterisk, end quote. Until recent years, emetophobia rarely appeared in the clinical literature. But the arrival of the Internet provided a means for emetophobes, many of whom had previously believed they were alone in their affliction, to find one another. Among celebrities who have reported themselves to be emetophobic are the actress Nicole Kidman, the musician Joan Baez, and Matt Lauer, the host of The Today Show. Online communities and support groups sprouted. The appearance of these virtual communities, some of which are quite large, by one estimate the form of the International Emetophobia Society has five times as many members as the largest flying phobia forum, came to the attention of anxiety researchers who have started to study this phobia more systematically. Like all anxiety disorders, emetophobia presents with elevated levels of physiological arousal, avoidance behavior, and also what experts call safety or neutralizing behavior, by which they mean doing what I do, carrying stomach remedies and anti-anxiety medications in case of emergency, attention disruption, meaning that in the presence of a phobic stimulus, such as a virus going around the office or through the family, we can concentrate on little else, and typically, problems with self-esteem and self-efficacy. We emetophobes tend to think poorly of ourselves and to believe we have trouble coping with the world and especially with something as catastrophic-seeming as vomiting. According to emerging research data, emetophobes also tend to demonstrate a heightened sensitivity to the opinions of others. As we've seen, both patients with panic disorder and patients with irritable bowel syndrome, who much of the time are the same patients, have what mental health experts call high somatization vulnerability, that is, a tendency to convert emotional distress into physical symptoms, and cognitive biases in the discrimination and interpretation of bodily symptoms, that is, they are especially conscious of even minor changes in physiology and have an attendant predisposition to interpret those symptoms in a catastrophic, worst-case scenario way. But whereas the primary concern for most panic patients tends to be that anxious bodily symptoms augur a heart attack or suffocation or insanity or death, emetophobes are afraid that the symptoms foretell imminent vomiting and also insanity and death. And whereas the fears of the panic patients are, except in rare cases of anxiety-induced sudden cardiac death, extremely unlikely to be realized, emetophobes are quite capable of bringing on, through their anxious symptoms, the very thing they fear most. Which, of course, is another reason to be constantly afraid of being constantly afraid. Is it any wonder that sometimes I feel like my brain is turning inside out? Psychologists have developed several standardized scales for measuring control freakiness. There is, for instance, Rotter's locus of control scale and also the health locus of control scale. That anxiety and depression are bound up tightly not only with self-esteem issues, but with control issues. Anxiety disorder patients tend both to feel like they don't have much control over their lives and to be afraid of losing control of their bodies or their minds, has been thoroughly established by generations of researchers. But that connection seems to be especially pronounced in people with emetophobia. A study published in the Journal of Clinical Psychology observed that emetophobics appear completely unable to negate their insatiable desire for the maintenance of control. I once dated a woman whose aunt had for decades been a full-blown bulimic. From her teens into sometime in her 30s, my girlfriend's aunt had made herself vomit after most meals. To me, this was as fascinating as it was unfathomable. Someone would actually choose to make herself vomit? I had known about anorexia and bulimia since junior high when I'd watched after-school specials about them on TV, but hadn't, to my knowledge, ever met anyone who voluntarily regurgitated on a regular basis. My whole life was built around trying not to vomit, and here was someone who vomited all the time, by choice? True, this person was mentally ill, easily diagnosable according to the DSM. Bulimia, eating in a discrete period of time an amount of food that is definitely larger than most people would eat during a similar period of time and under similar circumstances, combined with recurrent, inappropriate, compensatory behavior to prevent weight gain, such as 1. Self-induced vomiting. But wasn't I also, according to the very same authority, ill? Phobia. A. Marked and persistent fear that is excessive or unreasonable, cued by the presence or anticipation of a specific object or situation. B. Exposure to the phobic stimulus almost invariably provokes an immediate anxiety response, which may take the form of a situationally bound or situationally predisposed panic attack. Even at the time, it struck me that our disorders were oddly self-canceling. If I could get my mind to embrace the idea that some people vomited by choice to make themselves feel better, could that maybe lead me to accept that vomiting was not so catastrophic? And if bulimics could assimilate some of my horrified aversion to vomiting, mightn't that help to decondition them away from the practice? A modest proposal. Why not fill a group home with bulimics and emetophobes and hope that they model themselves out of their pathologies? The emetophobes, watching the bulimics make themselves vomit routinely, will learn that throwing up is not that big a deal. The bulimics, seeing the terror and disgust of the emetophobes, might be conditioned against such casual regurgitation. And anyway, aren't we fundamentally both, bulimics and emetophobes alike, afraid of the same thing? The loss of control? It's not so much being fat that anorexics fear, it's feeling out of control, a feeling that purging helps them perversely to combat. They binge and then, not feeling in control of their own appetites, seek to exert dominion over their bodies by purging. But locked into this cycle of binge and purge, they are not really in control at all. Dr. W. has pointed out what he believes is the obvious multi-layered symbolism of my emetophobia. Vomiting represents a loss of control and also my fear of letting my insides out, of revealing what's inside me. Most of all, he says, it represents my fear of death. Vomiting and my unruly, nervous stomach generally are inarguable evidence of my embodiedness and consequently of my mortality. As the British physician and philosopher Raymond Tallis has put it, one surefire cure for any whimsical or philosophical stance on one's own body is vomiting. Your body has you in its entire grip. There is a kind of terror in vomiting. It is a shouted reminder that we are embodied in an organism that has its own agenda. Someday I'm going to vomit. Someday I'm going to die. Am I wrong to live in quivering terror of both? I find the noodle and the stomach are antagonistic powers. What thought has to do with digesting roast beef, I cannot say, but they are brother faculties. Charles Darwin to his sister Caroline, 1838. I try to draw solace from the knowledge that I am hardly alone in having both a mind and a belly so easily perturbed by anxiety. Observers going back to Aristotle have noted that nervous dyspepsia and intellectual accomplishment often go hand in hand. Sigmund Freud's trip to the United States in 1909, which introduced psychoanalysis to this country, was marred, as he would later frequently complain, by his nervous stomach and bouts of diarrhea. Many of the letters between William and Henry James, first-class neurotics both, consist mainly of the exchange of various remedies for their stomach trouble. But for debilitating nervous stomach complaints, nothing compares to that which afflicted poor Charles Darwin, who spent decades of his life prostrated by his upset stomach. In 1865, he wrote a desperate letter to a physician named John Chapman, listing the array of symptoms that had plagued him for nearly 30 years. Age 56 to 57. For 25 years, extreme spasmodic daily and nightly flatulence, occasional vomiting, on two occasions prolonged during months. Vomiting preceded by shivering, hysterical crying, dying sensations or half-faint, and copious, very pallid urine. Now vomiting and every passage of flatulence preceded by ringing of ears, treading on air and vision. Nervousness, when Emma Darwin, his wife, leaves me. Even this list of symptoms is incomplete. At the urging of another doctor, Darwin had from July 1, 1849, to January 16, 1855, kept a Diary of Health, which eventually ran to dozens of pages and listed such complaints as chronic fatigue, severe stomach pain and flatulence, frequent vomiting, dizziness, swimming head, as Darwin described it, trembling, insomnia, rashes, eczema, boils, heart palpitations and pain, and melancholy. Darwin was frustrated that dozens of physicians, beginning with his own father, had failed to cure him. By the time he wrote to Dr. Chapman, Darwin had spent most of the past 3 decades, during which time he'd struggled heroically to write On the Origin of Species, housebound by general invalidism. Based on his diaries and letters, it's fair to say he spent a full third of his daytime hours since the age of 28 either vomiting or lying in bed. Chapman had treated many prominent Victorian intellectuals who were knocked up with anxiety at one time or another. He specialized in, as he put it, those high-strung neurotics whose minds are highly cultivated and developed and often complicated, modified, and dominated by subtle psychical influences whose intensity and bearing on the physical malady it is difficult to apprehend. He prescribed the application of ice to the spinal cord for almost all diseases of nervous origin. Chapman came out to Darwin's country estate in late May 1865, and Darwin spent several hours each day over the next several months encased in ice. He composed crucial sections of The Variation of Animals and Plants Under Domestication with ice bags packed around his spine. The treatment didn't work. The incessant vomiting continued. So while Darwin and his family enjoyed Chapman's company, we liked Dr. Chapman so very much, we were quite sorry the ice failed for his sake as well as ours, Darwin's wife wrote. By July, they had abandoned the treatment and sent the doctor back to London. Chapman was not the first doctor to fail to cure Darwin, and he would not be the last. To read Darwin's diaries and correspondence is to marvel at the more or less constant debilitation he endured after he returned from the famous voyage of the Beagle in 1836. The medical debate about what exactly was wrong with Darwin has raged for 150 years. The list proposed during his life and after his death is long. Amoebic infection, appendicitis, duodenal ulcer, peptic ulcer, migraines, chronic cholecystitis, smoldering hepatitis, malaria, catarrhal dyspepsia, arsenic poisoning, porphyria, narcolepsy, diabetogenic hyperinsulinism, gout, suppressed gout. What the devil is this suppressed gout, upon which doctors fasten every ill they cannot name? Darwin's friend Joseph Hooker wrote to him when informed of this diagnosis. If it is suppressed, how do they know it is gout? If it is apparent, why the devil do they call it suppressed? Chronic brucellosis, endemic to Argentina, which the Beagle had visited, Chagas disease, possibly contracted from a bug bite in Argentina, allergic reactions to the pigeons he worked with, complications from the protracted seasickness he experienced on the Beagle, and refractive anomaly of the eyes. I've just read an article, Darwin's Illness Revealed, published in a British academic journal in 2005, that attributes Darwin's ailments to lactose intolerance. The authors, two Welsh biochemists, studied Darwin's journals and health diary to draw correlations between his diet and his bouts of upset stomach. But a careful reading of Darwin's life suggests that the precipitating factor in every one of his most acute attacks of illness was anxiety. According to Ralph Kolp, a psychiatrist and historian, who in the 1970s combed through all the available Darwin journals, letters, and medical accounts, the worst periods of illness corresponded with stress either about his work on the theory of evolution or about his family. The anticipation of his wedding produced a bad headache, which continues 2 days and 2 nights, so that I doubted whether it ever meant to allow me to be married. In a 1997 article from the Journal of the American Medical Association called Charles Darwin and Panic Disorder, two doctors argue that, according to his own account of his symptoms, Darwin would easily qualify for the DSM-4's diagnosis of panic disorder with agoraphobia, since he demonstrated 9 of the 13 symptoms associated with it. Only 4 symptoms are required to receive the diagnosis. In 1918, Edward J. Kempf, an early American psychoanalyst, suggested in The Psychoanalytic Review that the trembling and eczema that afflicted Darwin's hands were evidence of neurotic hands, which would, Kempf concluded, lead one strongly to suspect an autoerotic difficulty that had not been completely mastered. Less outlandish psychological explanations ventured in the years since include hypochondriasis, depression, repressed feelings of guilt about his hostility toward his father, severe anxiety neurosis in an obsessional character certainly much complicated by genius, and bereavement syndrome produced by the loss of his mother at a very young age. Creationists have seized upon all this with zealous aplomb, implying in one pseudo-scholarly paper I came across that the evidence of mental illness suggests Darwin was psychotic, and that therefore his theory of evolution was the product of delusion. The voyage of the Beagle, 4 years and 9 months long, was a pivotal experience, enabling Darwin to develop his scientific work. Darwin's discovery of variant species of finches in the Galapagos Islands would eventually prompt his realization that species were not fixed for all time, but rather transmuted, or as he would later say, evolved over time. The months in port prior to the launch of the Beagle were, as Darwin would write in his old age, the most miserable which I ever spent. And that's saying something, given the terrible physical suffering he would later endure. I was out of spirits at the thought of leaving all my family and friends for so long a time, and the weather seemed to me inexpressibly gloomy, he recalled. I was also troubled with palpitations and pain about the heart, and like many a young ignorant man, especially one with a smattering of medical knowledge, was convinced I had heart disease. He also suffered from faintness and tingling in his fingers. These are all symptoms of anxiety, and in particular of the hyperventilation associated with panic disorder. Darwin forced himself to overcome his low spirits and embark on the voyage, and though he was beset by both claustrophobia, which put him in continual fear, and grievous seasickness, he was mostly healthy on the trip, gathering the evidence on which he would make his name and build his life's work. But after the Beagle docked in Falmouth, England, on October 2, 1836, Darwin would never again set foot outside England. After nearly 5 years of traveling, Darwin found his geographical ambit increasingly circumscribed. I dread going anywhere on account of my stomach so easily failing under any excitement, he told his cousin. It's remarkable that On the Origin of Species ever got written. Soon after his marriage, when Darwin was beginning in earnest his work on evolution, he suffered the first of his many episodes of periodic vomiting, stretches where he would vomit multiple times daily and be bedridden for weeks, or in several cases, years on end. Excitement or socializing of any kind could throw him into great physical upheaval. Parties or meetings would leave him knocked up with anxiety, bringing on violent shivering and vomiting attacks. I have therefore been compelled for many years to give up all dinner parties, he wrote. He installed a mirror outside his study window so he could see guests coming up the drive before they saw him, allowing him time to brace himself or to hide. In addition to Dr. Chapman's ice treatment, Darwin tried the water cure of the famous Dr. James Gully, who also treated Alfred Tennyson, Thomas Carlyle, and Charles Dickens around this time. Exercise, a sugar-free diet, brandy and Indian ale, chemical concoctions, scores of them, metal plates strapped to his torso meant to galvanize his insides, and electric chains made of brass and zinc wires meant to electrify him, and drenching his skin with vinegar. Whether the result of the placebo effect, distraction, or actual efficacy, some of these sort of worked some of the time. But always the illness returned. A day trip to London or any mild disturbance in his well-ordered routine would bring on a very bad form of vomiting that would send him to bed for days or weeks. Any work, especially on Origin, my abominable volume, as Darwin called it, could lay him low for months. I have been bad, having 2 days of bad vomiting owing to the accursed proofs, he wrote to a friend in early 1859 while going over printer's corrections. He installed a special lavatory in his study where he could vomit behind a curtain. He finished with the proofs amid fits of vomiting on October 1st, 1859, ending a 15-month period during which he had rarely been able to work free of stomach discomfort for more than 20 minutes at a time. When On the Origin of Species, More Than 20 Years in Gestation, was finally published in November 1859, Darwin was laid up in bed at a hydropathy spa in Yorkshire, his stomach in as much tumult as ever, his skin aflame. "I have been very bad lately," he wrote, "had an awful crisis. One leg swelled up like elephantiasis, eyes almost closed up, covered with a rash and fiery boils. It was like living in hell." One of Darwin's biographers, the British psychoanalyst John Bowlby, noted in the 1980s that the sorts of eruptions of boils and rashes that Darwin endured were thought by dermatologists to be associated with people who strive to suppress their feelings and who are given to low self-esteem and overwork. Bowlby, like other biographers, also observed that any stress or increase in arousal, however trivial, would produce physical symptoms in Darwin. Darwin continued in poor health even after the book's publication. "I shall go to my grave, I suppose, grumbling and growling with daily, almost hourly discomfort," he wrote in 1860. Those who argue that Darwin suffered from some germ-based or structural disease point to the severity and duration of his symptoms. "I must tell you how ill Charles has been," his wife wrote to a family friend in May 1864. "He has had almost daily vomiting for 6 months." But in rebuttal, there is this. When Darwin would stop working and go riding or walking in the Scottish Highlands or North Wales, his health would be restored. Charles is too much given to anxiety, as you know. Emma Darwin to a friend, 1851. If I seem unduly preoccupied with Darwin's stomach, perhaps you can understand why. It seems both apt and ironic that the man responsible for launching the modern study of fear and for identifying it as an emotion with concrete physiological and especially gastrointestinal effects was himself so miserably afflicted by a nervous stomach. Then there is the matter of his excessive dependence on his wife, Emma. "Without you, when I feel sick, I feel most desolate," he wrote to her at one point. "Oh, Mammy, I do long to be with you and under your protection, and then I feel safe," he wrote at another. Mammy? No wonder some Freudians would later argue that Darwin had dependency issues as well as Oedipal ones. I suppose this is the place to say that, based on my burdensome over-reliance on my wife and, before that, on my parents, Dr. W. has diagnosed me with dependent personality disorder, which is, according to the DSM-5, characterized by excessive psychological dependence on other people, most often a loved one or caretaker, and the belief that one is inadequate and helpless to cope on one's own. Finally, of course, there is the matter of Darwin's decades of constant vomiting. For an emetophobe like me, this holds a morbid fascination. His anxiety produced vomiting, yet his vomiting did not, or so it seems, produce additional anxiety. Moreover, Darwin lived, despite his years of vomiting, to the old for the time age of 73. Shouldn't Darwin's accomplishments, in defiance of such a debilitating gastrointestinal affliction, provide reassurance that if, say, I were to throw up just once, or even five times, or even five times in a day, or even, like Darwin, five times a day for years on end, I might not only survive, but perhaps even remain productive? If you're not an emetophobe, this question surely seems impossibly strange. Patent evidence of the irrational obsession at the core of my mental illness. And you're right. But if you are an emetophobe, well, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. Chapter 4. Performance Anxiety. Many lamentable effects this fear causeth in man, as to be red, pale, tremble, sweat. It makes sudden cold and heat to come over all the body, palpitation of the heart, syncope, etc. It amazeth many men that are to speak or show themselves in public assemblies or before some great personages, as Tully confessed of himself, that he trembled still at the beginning of his speech, and Demosthenes, that great orator of Greece, before Philippus. Robert Burton, The Anatomy of Melancholy, 1621. All public speaking of merit is characterized by nervousness. Cicero, 1st century A.D. I've finally settled on a pre-talk regimen that enables me to avoid the weeks of anticipatory misery that the approach of a public speaking engagement would otherwise produce. Let's say I'm speaking to you at some sort of public event. Here's what I've likely done to prepare. 4 hours or so ago, I took my first half milligram of Xanax. I've learned that if I wait too long to take it, my sympathetic nervous system goes so far into overdrive that medication is not enough to yank it back. Then, about an hour ago, I took my second half milligram of Xanax and perhaps 20 milligrams of Inderol. I need the whole milligram of Xanax plus the Inderol, which is a blood pressure medication or beta blocker that dampens the response of the sympathetic nervous system to keep my physiological responses to the anxious stimulus of standing in front of you, the sweating, trembling, nausea, burping, stomach cramps, and constriction in my throat and chest from overwhelming me. I likely washed those pills down with a shot of scotch, or more likely, of vodka. Even 2 Xanax and an Inderol are not enough to calm my racing thoughts and to keep my chest and throat from constricting to the point where I cannot speak. I need the alcohol to slow things down and to dampen the residual physiological eruptions that the drugs are inadequate to contain. In fact, I probably drank my second shot. Yes, even though I might be speaking to you at, say, 9 in the morning, between 15 and 30 minutes ago, assuming the pre-talk proceedings allowed me a moment to sneak away for a quaff. And depending on how intimidating an audience I anticipated you would be, I might have made that second shot a double or a triple. If the usual pattern has held, as I stand up here, talking to you now, I've got some Xanax in one pocket, in case I felt the need to pop another one before being introduced, and a mini-bar-sized bottle or two of vodka in the other. I've been known to take a discreet last-second swig while walking on stage, because even as I'm still experiencing the anxiety that makes me want to drink more, my inhibition has been lowered and my judgment impaired by the liquor and benzodiazepines I've already consumed. If I've managed to hit the sweet spot, that perfect combination of timing and dosage where the cognitive and psychomotor sedating effect of the drugs and alcohol balances out the physiological hyperarousal of the anxiety, then I'm probably doing okay up here. Nervous, but not miserable. A little fuzzy, but still able to convey clarity. The anxiogenic effects of the situation, me speaking in front of people, counteracted by the anxiolytic effects of what I've consumed. Together, the alcohol and the benzodiazepines slow the firing of neurons in my amygdala, increase transmission of dopamine and gamma-aminobutyric acid, boost production of beta endorphins in my hypothalamus, and decrease transmission of acetylcholine. But if I've overshot on the medication, too much Xanax or liquor, I may seem loopy or slurring or otherwise impaired. And if I didn't self-medicate enough, well then, either I'm miserable and probably sweating profusely, with my voice quavering weakly and my attention folding in upon itself, or, more likely, I ran off stage before I got this far. I know. My method of dealing with my public speaking anxiety is not healthy. It's evidence of alcoholism. It's dangerous. But it works. Only when I'm sedated to near stupefaction by a combination of benzodiazepines and alcohol do I feel relatively confident in my ability to speak in public effectively and without misery. As long as I know that I'll have access to my Xanax and liquor, I'll suffer only moderate anxiety for days before a speech, rather than miserable, sleepless dread for months. Self-medicating, sometimes dangerously so, is a time-honored way of warding off performance anxiety. Starting when he was 30, William Gladstone, the long-serving British Prime Minister, would drink laudanum, opium dissolved in alcohol, with his coffee before speeches in Parliament. Once, he accidentally overdosed and had to go to a sanatorium to recover. William Wilberforce, the famous 18th-century British anti-slavery politician, took opium as a calmer of nerves before all his speeches in Parliament. To that, Wilberforce said of his pre-speech opium regimen, I owe my success as a public speaker. Of course, to opium, Wilberforce likely owed many other things, too. Among them, his horrible depression and a host of physical problems. After initially being prescribed the drug for bowel troubles, he became addicted, taking it every day for 45 years straight. Laurence Olivier, convinced that he was about to be driven to what he was sure would be reported as a mystifying and scandalously sudden retirement by his stage fright, finally confided his distress to the actress Dame Sybil Thorndike and her husband. Take drugs, darling, Thorndike told him. We do. Actually, Olivier seems not to have resorted to drugs. There was no other treatment than the well-worn practice of wearing it, the terror, out, he wrote in his autobiography. And it was in that determined spirit that I got on with the job. But he did quit the stage for 5 years to escape his anxiety. I try to draw solace from what I have learned about Gladstone, Olivier, and other successful and exalted people who have been debilitated by their stage fright. Demosthenes, a Greek statesman renowned for his oratorical skills, was, early in his career, jeered for his anxious, stammering performances. Cicero, the great Roman statesman and philosopher, once froze while speaking during an important trial in the Forum and ran off stage. I turn pale at the outset of a speech and quake in every limb and in all my soul, he wrote. Moses, according to various interpretations of Exodus 4:10, had a fear of public speaking or was a stutterer. He overcame this to become the voice of his people. Every era of history seems to offer up examples of prominent, accomplished figures who managed, or didn't manage, to overcome crippling public speaking anxiety. On the morning before William Cowper, the 18th-century British poet, was to appear before the House of Lords to discuss his qualifications for a government position, he tried to hang himself, preferring to die rather than endure a public appearance. The suicide attempt failed, and the interview was postponed. They, to whom a public examination of themselves on any occasion is mortal poison, may have some idea of the horrors of my situation, Cowper wrote. Others can have none. In 1889, a young Indian lawyer froze during his first case before a judge and ran from the courtroom in humiliation. My head was reeling, and I felt as though the whole court was doing likewise, the lawyer would write later, after he had become known as Mahatma Gandhi. I could think of no question to ask. Another time, when Gandhi stood up to read remarks he had prepared for a small gathering of a local vegetarian society, he found he could not speak. My vision became blurred, and I trembled, though the speech hardly covered a sheet of foolscap, he recounted. What Gandhi called the awful strain of public speaking prevented him for years from speaking up even at friendly dinner parties and nearly deterred him from developing into the spiritual leader he ultimately became. Thomas Jefferson, too, had his law career disrupted by a fear of public speaking. One of his biographers notes that if he tried to declaim loudly, his voice would sink in his throat. He never spoke during the deliberations of the Second Continental Congress and, remarkably, he gave only two public speeches, his inaugural addresses, during his years as president. After reviewing Jefferson's biographies, psychiatrists at Duke University, writing in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, diagnosed him posthumously with social phobia. The novelist Henry James dropped out of law school after giving what he felt was an embarrassing performance in a moot court competition, in which he quavered and collapsed into silence. Thereafter, he avoided making formal public presentations, despite being known for his witty dinner party repartee. Vladimir Horowitz, perhaps the most talented concert pianist of the 20th century, developed stage fright so acute that for 15 years he refused to perform in public. When he finally returned to the stage, he did so only on the condition that he could clearly see his personal physician sitting in the front row of the audience at all times. Barbara